Call Senate State Affairs to order. It is exactly 9 o'clock according to my phone. And let the record reflect, we have Senator Wilkowski, Vice Chair Senator Geisel, and myself, Chair Dyson. Today we're going to deal with three items. We're going to start with Senate Concurrent Resolutions 20 Sexual Awareness Month. I suspect that won't take much time. And then House Bill 19, Permanent Motor Vehicle Registration Trailers by Representative Stoltz. And then we'll take up SB 30. We will not be passing SB 30 out today. We'll see how it goes with SB 19, but I know there's a lot of folks here that want to testify, and we'll try to be as thoughtful and responsible. Senator Geisel has a bill up in finance, and I'm amongst the walking wounded here today, and so it may be that both of us will be gone around 10-ish, but the other folks are here, and they will get the testimony to us and so on, but please don't think we're being disrespectful. So who's here on SCR 20? Please identify yourself for the record.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. Edra Morledge, staff to Senator Meyer. He had a prior commitment in another committee, so unfortunately he can't be here this morning. SCR 20 is a resolution proclaiming April 2014 as Sexual Assault Awareness Month. It's part of a national campaign to raise awareness and educate communities on the crimes of sexual assault and how to prevent sexual violence across the nation. Sexual violence is a very serious public health problem that affects millions of women and men, and the CDC reports that in the United States, 1 in 5 women and 1 in 71 men have been victims of violent sexual assault at some point in their lifetime. In Alaska, however, those rates are much higher. In fact, they're about 2.5 times the national average. And unfortunately, statistics alone underestimate the problem because many victims do not tell the police, family, or friends about the violence. Sexual violence impacts health in many ways and can lead to very long-term physical and mental health problems. And by bringing awareness to the crime of sexual assault by a simple resolution, it's a very significant step, although it seems maybe just passing a resolution isn't doing too much, but it is actually bringing awareness and can help educate our communities, specifically in the state of Alaska, to lift the veil of secrecy that so often hides some of these really horrific crimes. Our Council on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault, the Executive Director, Lori Morton, is here, who can answer some more specific questions about statistics in the state of Alaska, if committee members would like. They also have several public awareness campaigns, such as the 4th R and the Green Dot Program, that I'm sure she would be happy to go into more detail about those programs across the state of Alaska. And with that, that concludes my presentation.
Questions, comments from the committee? Part of the value of you and your boss doing this is just to increase awareness. We don't have, I don't think hardly anybody here from the press, and I'm sure you'll get out a very good press release when it passes, and I suspect you're hustling to get it done before the 1st of April, and we want to accommodate you. So if it's okay with you, unless there's people here that really, it's going to pass out of here. And so unless there's people here that feel they need to speak, I would just soon move the bill. Is anyone uncomfortable with that? All right. Senator Geisel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move Senate Concurrent Resolution Number 20, Version 28LS1601 Alpha from this committee with zero fiscal note and accompanying individual recommendations.
Is there objection? Seeing none, we'll take a brief at ease to sign the documents. back on the record, we'll take up, what, 19? Yep. CS for House Bill 19, Rules. Amended, it's the backslash A version. Is that the one you want us to have?
I believe. Let me make sure I got the
one. Or the V version, or U version.
It's the NA version?
Yes.
Backslash N.A.
Okay. Yeah. All right. So we'll take up the 28-LS0130 / N.A version as our working document. Please identify yourself for the record and give us your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Dyson. Through the chair, my name is Darrell Breach, staff representative Bill Stoltz, sponsor of this legislation. HB 19 is legislation that provides the option for Alaskans to obtain permanent registration for motor vehicles, non-commercial motor vehicles, that are 8 years old or older, and also for non-commercial trailers that they own. This is modeled after similar legislation that passed several years ago in Montana, which allows permanent registration for motor vehicles there. They chose 11 years for their benchmark. We chose 8 years for our benchmark for this legislation because the motor vehicle registration tax that is charged levels out after 8 years. It's a set rate that starts at a higher amount for newer vehicles and reduces down. And once a vehicle reaches 8 years, that rate stays flat for the life of the vehicle from that point forward. So we chose 8 years as a good benchmark based on the motor vehicle registration tax rate. Thought it would be easier for DMV to deal with a consistent thing at 8 years if things level out there to move forward. HB 19 also includes what was amended in the House Rules Committee, a section that requires municipalities and boroughs to basically opt into the program. They have to pass an ordinance that allows the residents of their municipalities and boroughs to obtain the permanent vehicle registration for their non-commercial vehicles and for non-commercial trailers. These trailers are snow machine trailers, boat trailers, horse trailers, anything that's being used for a non-commercial purpose. Tool trailers that construction workers tell would be, it's kind of questionable where that is, and we'll leave that to DMV to determine how that, if it's a commercial vehicle at that point or if it's a non-commercial trailer, because often they're used for multiple purposes.
Welcome, Representative Stoltz. Yeah, please.
Let the representative continue if you would like talking about
this. No, why don't you keep that? I don't know when you stopped.
Okay.
He's on a roll.
I just summarizing the bill. The important thing to note with the legislation is DMV takes in more in registration fees than is needed to operate, estimated to the tune of about $38 million extra. Amy Erickson hears from the DMV. She could probably speak to more details as to what the extra revenue they generate is and what they bring in for that purpose. Representative Stoltz, has anything to add? Or I'll take you through a sectional summary of the bill.
Bill Stoltz, House Station 11, Southern Rural Matsu and Chugiak, half of your Senate district. Yeah. A lot of this is about philosophy as well as finance. And I don't dispute the fiscal notes and the computation. I think the department has to be conservative, but a lot of people are willing to spend even more money not to have to deal with government. And with our transients and population, many people will register a lifetime and end up moving, especially if some good things don't happen to the economy. Things happen. You sell your car. You transfer it to another. There's a lot of factors. But that said, on the larger face, I'll accept the fiscal impact. But the bigger motivation than money for our constituency, Senator Dyson, is not having to deal with government as often, and especially on the issue of recreational trailers, non-commercial trailers. People often even forget. If the registration's expired, if you don't use them every year, a snow machine trailer. You know, the line of work I've chosen, that's something that's very easy for me not to use my snow machine for multiple years in a row on any place other than local. Same if you're a recreational fisherman. You might have seasons where you don't even get your boat in the water. It's not having to deal with it. It's a consideration we gave to commercial users, much more generous terms for commercial trailers before I was here in the legislature, I think probably in the late 90s, early 2000s. But a lot of this is about the philosophy of, first, it's does the government need money? Well, yes, a lot of, and that's, and as well as the local governments. Part of that debate's been settled in the amendment that the House Rules Committee did, that the debate on our side, and I support it staying the same, yes, following the process, is money that I lost on that, and many of my colleagues felt that the Treasury was more important than people's liberties. And but that said, we're moving onward. But I think the average constituent, if they didn't have to go to DMV, we know that in the private sector they'll pay that extra $10. We got rid of the IM test before we got rid of the IM test. Or, well, you're getting your oil changed. People will pay for the convenience of not having to go to a DMV office. And it's the same item. And there's a point how much, I guess it's the same philosophy some people have about property taxes. And at what point have you paid your due on different item, but it has some of the same components. And do you ever really own your car if the government always has a piece of it? And after so many years, unlike a piece of it, should you have an option to say, I don't want to deal with this again? It's probably too cumbersome to try to figure out a plan like that for property taxes. But this is a very modest proposal to try to react to something that's been requested and been festering for a long time. Frankly, when I first introduced the bill, the expectations were so high. When I walked into the grocery stores in the Valley and in Chugiak and Eagle River, people asked me, Bill, when can I start doing that? And we know that dynamic. The expectations get raised when we introduce a bill. But, so whatever you, as a collective, your collective desire is, if it moves forward, I'm ecstatic. It's, I'd rather have a different bill, but I understand how the process has been modulated by the I wouldn't say concerns, I would say the demands of the municipalities. If we at least have an option to try to implement this, I believe the Mat-Su Borough is one government that would look at this seriously. The mayor has said they would look at this, and our assembly has endorsed it. So,
all right.
I didn't mean to ramble on so long.
So, first glance, I was a little confused, but it is only for privately owned and used trailers. Correct?
And vehicles. And motor vehicles.
And motor vehicles. All right.
And Senator Dyson, many folks have told me that they get around that. They say, I just say I'm using it commercially, and they get the $25 fee. And I've had, and that's an, that's what happens when you're trying to avoid government.
Yeah. And there could be a issue. Somebody has a motor vehicle, they have it registered, and they sell it. This is some, you know, and he doesn't bother to change the registration, so he can coast on for 6 or 7 years and leave the vehicle, in essence, in the previous owner's name. Did that subject ever come up?
Senator Dyson, hasn't come up any more than it comes up that people will sell a private vehicle. And you know, the dynamics that sometimes occur, you start getting parking tickets because the person hasn't re-registered the vehicle, even if you send in the slip. I think it would have the same problems that are attended, and I think that'd be something DMV ought to be able to figure out a way to fix. But it's not addressed in my bill, but it's a problem that exists with or without my bill.
Yeah, and you're right. And when you transfer a title, there's a piece you tear off, and the seller is supposed to submit that to DMV so that they will know that there is a pending transfer.
Even when they do, Senator, we have abundant problems. Yes. When the other party does it.
Yes.
Through the chair, Section 2 of the bill also addresses the fact, and Section 4, that the permanent registration is non-transferable. So when the vehicle sells and the seller sends in that slip, the registration at that point then expires if they have a permanent registration. Would then expire if they have permanent registration.
All right. I was also a little bit confused. Would this only work, does a organized municipality have to do their own ordinances before this can be effective in their area?
Yeah. Senator Dyson, the statute would have to pass, and then the municipality would be authorized to do their own ordinance.
But it is permissive.
Permissive, correct.
Yeah. So line one of the bill, or close to that, there's a shall in there. Yeah, that's line 7 on page 1. Maybe I'm on the wrong version here.
Line 8, maybe?
Line 8.
Yeah, probably. Line 8 in the... Yeah, line 8. Yeah.
So, Senator Dyson, I believe that means in conformance with the way that DMV requires registration, right? But I would defer to the division and Department of Administration.
Yeah, so, yeah, I was just thinking about a scenario where the municipality didn't do their own ordinances, you know, and if this shall compels them, we can ask. Other questions, comments from the committee? All right, seeing none.
Fiscal note, I don't know if the new fiscal note reflects. What's your calculation on how much this will cost us?
Through the chair, the current fiscal note with the changes that were made in rules is indeterminate as to the cost. I imagine Amy Erickson could speak to any additional costs for DMV in establishing the permanent registration. But with the current fiscal note, the structure that's there, it's difficult to determine which municipalities and boroughs would pass an ordinance allowing for this. So I believe that's why they came up with the indeterminate fiscal note.
To continue.
There's one that I'm looking at from, I think it's DMV. It's got 2015, a positive $5.9 million, and then loss of $17 million in 2016, $20 million in 2017, $20 million in 18, and $22 million in 19. Has that been changed, or is that?
Through the chair, Senator Rolikowski, that physical note has been changed with the amendment that was adopted to make it an optional, so the municipalities have to opt in. They don't know not knowing which municipalities will opt in, it's hard to determine which vehicles how many vehicles will be eligible to be registered permanently. That's kind of been shifted a little bit. If all the municipalities and boroughs opt in, I imagine the fiscal note that you have before you would probably apply.
Okay. And follow up, Mr. Chair, if I could. Is there a loss to the municipalities because of this, or the boroughs?
Mr. Chair, Senator Wilikowski, they determine whether or not they want to embark upon this. That's up to how they react locally.
I mean, just explain to me how, when someone walks in, pays their $120 registration fee, how much of that goes to the union, how much goes to the state? I thought it all went to the state, no?
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, currently 16 different municipalities throughout the state charge motor vehicle registration tax, and the rate is different depending on where you're at and the age of the vehicle. The motor vehicle registration tax fee is something the state DMV collects and forwards on to the municipality. It's a municipal tax. It's not a state tax, what you're paying when you register your vehicle. So would there be a loss to the municipalities if they adopt this? Possibly. The bill also allows in, let me find the section here so I can refer to it for you. In section 7, it allows for municipalities to set a motor vehicle registration tax rate for vehicles that are registered permanently. Currently, it's the rate caps out at 8 years, and you pay that when you're only at the time of registration. So you're paying the registration fee for an 8-year-old vehicle. If you're registering permanently, then the municipalities, if they choose to adopt it, can set a rate that they determine is reasonable for a vehicle that's going to be registered permanently. And that's something they would have to calculate to what it would be to offset any potential loss that they may see under the if they don't adopt a permanent registration fee.
Good, Mr. Chair. I'm just trying to get a rough estimate of how much this is going to cost my community of Anchorage. And do you know what the tax is for Anchorage?
I do.
Roughly?
And it only costs Anchorage money if they make the conscious decision. So it's that's a debate that will end up occurring there. And Mayor Sullivan says he doesn't like this, so I assume he'd have to get at least 8 assembly votes to override a veto if you follow it. And he was very active in opposing this legislation, so which is about next to dip netting is probably the most popular issue I push.
Through the chair, in response to Senator Bulkowski's question as to what the exact cost
of municipality. Identify your name, please, Daryl. Identify your name for the record.
Daryl Brees, Representative Stoltz. Through the chair, Senator Bulkowski, in answer to the cost question as to what it will cost the municipality, the first question is determining how many vehicles, if they adopt this, do register permanently, and that's a guessing game that's difficult to determine. The motor vehicle registration tax for a vehicle that's 8 years old in the municipality of Anchorage is $70 per year. So when you register your vehicle, you pay $100 for the biennial fee, plus then the $70 motor vehicle registration tax. If you multiply that out times the number of years that an individual is going to own the vehicle, which is difficult to predict, you can come up with an estimate for that number, but exactly what that number is, that's something the DMV could probably give you a better estimate of, what their guess is.
And I'm just doing some rough math here, Mr. Chair. The assumption that DMV made was that there were 478,000 vehicles that would qualify for this statewide. Anchorage is 42% of the state, so roughly 200,000 times 35 equals, my rough math is $7 million bucks or so per year lost to Anchorage if they adopted it.
And assuming no one sells the vehicle, moves out of Anchorage, or anything beyond that nature, that's their estimate, yes.
All right, thank you.
And assuming the bill doesn't require vehicles 8 years or older to take the permanent registration, an individual can determine, you know, I'm going to sell the vehicle in a couple of years, so I'm not going to pay the extra $25 for the permanent registration fee. So what the exact math is there is at best a guess.
Senator Giesel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And following along that same line, actually, if the municipalities structure this and collect the tax themselves, they'll be 8% ahead, because right now, DMV collecting that tax, they keep 8% of the municipality's tax as their administrative fee.
That is correct.
part of what confused me a bit is I read the title in both versions. It says, related to registration fees for non-commercial trailers and the tax for trailers. And that's what confused me about when you said it applied to all vehicles.
On the previous version of the bill, that's what I refer to. There is a tax for both vehicles and trailers, and there's a tax for, so that's just a reference to both, to both the tax fees that are there for.
No, I understand that, but it wasn't clear to me in the title that this applied to vehicles that weren't trailers. What am I missing?
Senator Dyson, Bill Stoltz, I don't think you're missing anything. It's in the title. We've been real clear on the record every iteration. That's, and the fact that it is vehicles, that's what generated the larger fiscal speculation by the division of motor vehicles. If this was just trailers, we'd be talking some pretty small numbers.
Other questions? Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I ran an amendment on the floor on the last DMV bill that we had to cut DMV fees by 15%, and people rejected that, saying we couldn't afford it. Is that something you would support as an amendment to this bill?
Well, through the chair, Senator Wilkowski. Well, it really becomes moot because this issue is really about the local option now, and any municipality could make that decision. I guess I don't have a position on a proposed amendment, but it's not the focus. It's not the focus of my legislation.
All right, I have Colleen Greenshield from. In Anchorage from DMV. Is there anybody from DMV here in the room? Yeah, you want to come join us? Thought I saw you lurking back there. always delighted to see you.
Thank you.
Please identify yourself for the record.
Amy Erickson, Director of the Division of Motor Vehicles. I'm here for questions, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, so the question is, what's the impact on the department you expect?
We don't really expect an impact to us, per se. We already offer a permanent registration tab for those 65 years and older, so we can issue a P-tab to any municipality that does opt in. We would service them with a P-tab.
Chair Dyson, so at some point, if a lot of people choose this option, I'll unload your staff a bit for not having to do with annual or whatever. Any sense of, you know, if you have 5,000 vehicles that you're now not having to register every year, get any idea what it'd make to your staff time?
Actually, Mr. Chairman, we haven't contemplated that yet, but it's a good point.
Yeah, I doubt if you'll be laying off people, but it may indeed reduce your expansion.
Sure.
Other questions? Senator Wilkowski.
Follow up on that. There's a couple fiscal notes in here that show losses of getting around $20, $22 million a year. Is that what the loss is projected to be?
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski,
assuming that the municipalities opt in.
Yes, the figures were that large when we were talking about it being for all municipalities.
When it was mandatory.
That's right.
Yeah. What's your sense of that language on line 8 of the NA version?
Mr. Chairman, I didn't have any heartburn with that. It was no different than how it is in current statute.
Okay.
It speaks to how we handle registration.
All right. If anyone else wants to testify? Any questions or comments from the committee? Brief and easy. Record, Chair, I'd like to entertain a motion.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move CS for House Bill number 19, Rules Amended, Version 28, LS0130, November Alpha, from this committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note.
Objection?
Not objection. I just wanted to declare a potential conflict. I have two vehicles that would meet the requirement here.
I rule that your conflict is not discernible from the rest of the population. All right, thank you for putting that on the record. All right. Is there any objection? Seeing none, we'll take a brief at ease and sign it.
Chair, members of the committee.
Wait a minute. Back on the record.
I'm sorry.
Senator Egan.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Senator Dennis Egan. I represent District P, including Juneau. I want to thank all of you for finally hearing this bill. Senate Bill 30 lets teachers, troopers, firefighters, and other public employees choose one of two state pension systems, an individual defined contribution retirement account or earning a defined benefit pension. A defined benefit pension takes time to earn, but it rewards public servants by letting them earn a guaranteed monthly benefit when they retire. And for long-term employees, they can even earn paying for retiree health care. Alaska teachers and public employees don't earn the private sector's defined benefit or of Social Security, and many even lose Social Security benefits they earned in past jobs. So for most, a defined benefit pension makes sense, but many will choose a defined contribution that we currently have. Some have military or private sector pensions, and some have a spouse that's deployed here in Alaska and don't plan to stay in Alaska for more than a few years. Others want to control their investment or take their savings to their next job. Senate Bill 30 creates a new, more stable, more predictable defined benefit pension for public servants, the tier that they can choose. A few years ago, Alaska beefed up oversight of the pension system, and Senate Bill 30 keeps those smart safeguards, making Alaska's retirement system stronger than ever. Analysis of a previous version of the bill showed it saves the state more than $70 million over 5 years, and it is cost neutral in the long run. It shares the risk of rising health care costs between employers and employees. It adds nothing, not one red cent, to the unfunded liabilities from the past. And to make the new system...
Excuse me, Dennis.
Yes.
Senator Egan, for the record, Senator Coghill joined us about 12, 14 minutes ago. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm almost done. To make the new system cost neutral, employees will share the risk of health care in the future. That's a risk worth taking, and I believe it's fair to Alaskans. I have Jesse Keel on my staff that will further explain it, and we will... have an actuary that is online provide a PowerPoint
and
presentation.
Questions for Senator Egan? Senator Egan, I think you implied with your testimony that under this program, their retirement program is mobile and they could take it with them. Did you? Is that what I understood?
The defined contribution. If they chose defined contribution.
Okay, but in the defined benefit that you're proposing, it's not portable?
They can cash it out if they want, but it doesn't make a heck of a lot of sense for the person to do that, I don't think. But this is me.
All right. Please continue, Jesse.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Jesse Keel, staff to Senator Dennis Egan. To speak, I guess, directly as a beginning to your question, the structure of Senate Bill 30 does create a one-time choice for a newly hired employee between the current defined contribution system, in which the employee has an individual account in which those funds are entirely portable as the employee moves to a new job, subject to a vesting schedule in the employer's contribution, and a defined benefit system, a pension, which those funds are generally not portable. And so the employee would need at the time of hire to make some decisions with consequences down the road. And Senator Egan went down some of the situations in which a defined contribution system might make the most sense. There are a lot of situations in which a defined benefit would be the better choice for an employee. For the benefit of those in the room who are not intimately familiar with how defined benefits works, the very broad strokes overview would be that the system aims to invest, to put away enough money each year to fund the future benefits that employees earn in that year. That's called, referred to by the actuaries as the normal cost rate, and you'll see that term in the bill. Both employees and employers put money into the system in Alaska's public employees retirement system and teachers retirement system. And those funds are invested in trust funds. Those trust funds are able, with an open defined benefit system, open pension system, to invest for the very, very long term. And that enables the trust funds to earn returns comparable to Alaska's permanent fund. Over the very long term, they have historically been in the neighborhood or just slightly north of 8%. Those investment earnings are very important. 55 to 60% of the benefits that PERS and TERS pay in the defined benefit in the pension system come from investment earnings. That economic efficiency really allows Alaskans to get the most for the dollars, the payroll dollars that they put into these systems. But you can't strike it rich with Alaska's pensions. The average PERS pension is in the low to middle $25,000 range, per year. The TERS pension runs about, the average TERS pension runs about $34,000 a year. And those numbers take a long time to earn, generally a couple of decades. Of course, the longer, with longer service, as Senator Regan mentioned, an employee can earn retiree health insurance. Under the tier created in Senate Bill 30, the pension tier, that employee will always pay a portion of the monthly premium, which is an important distinction from the previous defined benefit tiers, where once you qualified, your premiums were covered by the trust funds.
Hopefully.
Legally, the trust fund pays the premium for the employee who is eligible. One of the benefits of the defined contribution system, and that's a system to which Senate Bill 30 does not make any changes, is that employees get the opportunity to control their own investments. Many individuals are skilled investment managers. They do a good job with their investments. They have the opportunity to create for themselves a retirement nest egg that will pay a better retirement living than the pension system. But there are no guarantees, and many economists talk today about America's looming retirement crisis. The average American employee aged 55 to 64, coming up on retirement, has $165,000 in retirement savings. But that's the average. More than half of U.S. workers have only $10,000 put away. And it's important to note, as the fiduciaries for the state of Alaska, that the state is always the payer of last resort. We have no trust fund for the state's share of senior Medicaid benefits. We have no trust fund for senior care, for the state's share of heating assistance. All of those things have a 0% funded ratio, unlike Alaska's defined benefits system. Another important consideration for you as the state's board of directors is the high cost of recruitment and retention. This is especially important to municipalities who seek to get the best value they can for the public's property and sales tax dollars. The cost of hiring, cost of training, are very high. The examples I have from state service would be the biologist to recruit, to hire, and to train in the first year runs in the neighborhood of $15,000 to $16,000. For peace officers, that's a great deal higher. In the first 2 years, that cost can reach $150,000 for a new peace officer. Employers are very rightly concerned about this cost, especially as the national employment situation improves and Alaska attempts to hold down wage growth in tight budget times. It is very difficult to continue to pay for high turnover. And so with the option for employees to choose a defined benefit system who wish to remain, we remove the incentive to vest in the employer contributions in defined contribution and then move to a state that does offer a pension. To go briefly over some of the changes in the new pension tier that Senate Bill 30 creates, Mr. Chairman, most employees will pay in at a significantly higher percent of their payroll. General government workers will go from 6.75% of their pay to 8% of their pay, a genuine reduction in their take-home to fund the benefit if they choose it. Senate Bill 30 also takes longer for retirees to earn help in paying for their retiree health insurance. That threshold for most employees will be Medicare eligibility. And it's important to note that that's not an age in the bill. That's eligibility for the program. So if the federal government moves that eligibility age, Alaska will not be on the hook for the years between retirement and Medicare eligibility, the most expensive years in some of the legacy pension systems we have now. The other important consideration, and Senator Regan mentioned sharing the risk with employees, is that Senate Bill 30, the new pension tier, adjusts the retiree's portion of the health insurance premium so that the new tier does not cost the state of Alaska more than the defined contribution tier that we currently offer and would continue to offer under the bill. that's as Senator Regan said, that's an important risk-sharing element. And if medical care costs continue as they have over the very long term, looking back, that will cost employees, retirees, a significant amount. If recent years' cost experience, where over the last two audited years we've only had, I think, 2% growth in medical costs, continue, then employees will not face that increased cost when they retire. But that element of risk sharing is an important part of how the bill balances and keeps the state and municipal employers whole in terms of paying that normal cost and pre-funding those benefits. Mr. Chairman, the bill gives current employees in the defined contribution system, those who were hired and did not have a choice, one opportunity to make the switch if they choose. That switch would be irrevocable. It would also be at the employee's cost if the current balance of their individual account is not enough money as calculated by the actuary to pre-fund the full time they've served. They would only get credit for the time they've served unless the employee chooses to move more of their own money into the system to fully pre-fund that service time. And the bill's very specific. Under no circumstances could anyone convert and get credit for more time than they actually served. If you had a remarkable investor who had enough money in their individual account to more than fund the actual years of service they had, that additional balance would not fund more service years. You only get the time you worked in that idealized situation. Mr. Chairman, having looked briefly at the fiscal note and some of the analysis underlying it late last night, the analysis by Buck, the systems actuary, shows that over the first years, Senate Bill 30 should save the state just slightly shy of $69 million. After, I don't have it in front of me, I believe it's 4 or 5 years in PERS, after about 12 years, I think, in the teacher's retirement system, and I'm sure those numbers are off by a couple of years, then the adjustments are predicted to go into effect to the retiree medical system, and the system will be cost neutral as compared to the defined contribution system. I do note a line in the administration's fiscal note, Mr. Chairman, with which the sponsor takes some exception. It refers to, when those adjustments take effect, creating an unfunded liability. In fact, Mr. Chairman, that's an important semantic difference. When those adjustments take effect, the retiree's medical premiums will fund that additional liability. That will not be an unfunded to the state. And so I want to clarify the sponsor's intent and understanding of the bill, and I know that you'll have an actuary to speak to that as well. Just to finish, Mr. Chairman, we're all keenly aware that there is no such thing as a riskless retirement system. We have had systems in the past where the state bore all risk. We have a defined contribution system now where the employee bears all risk, at least until a retiree potentially runs out of money, in which case, again, the state is the payer of last resort. Senate Bill 30, Mr. Chairman, invests carefully and wisely for the future. It saves the state and municipalities money in the near term. It saves money on turnover and retention recruitment costs in the mid and long term, and it shares the risk to remain cost neutral. I respectfully ask your support, Mr. Chairman, and unless there are questions for me, I would ask that Mr. Fornia be granted the opportunity to present. He has a slideshow here that I'm happy to run for him.
Questions or comments from the committee? I'll wait till after the presentation. Go ahead with the presentation. Introduce whoever it is. Fornia, Mr. Fornia. Can you hear us, Mr. Fornia?
I was just unmuted, so yes, I can hear you, and I'm guessing you can hear me. Is that correct?
Yeah, speak up a little bit or pull the mic closer to you, and thank you, and thanks for helping us out. Please identify yourself and give us your testimony and slideshow.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is William Fornia. I'm an actuary engaged by the Alaska Public Pension Coalition, and I believe I testified a couple years ago in Fairbanks, and I recognize a couple of you from back then. This bill is somewhat similar to 121 from 2 years ago, And basically the idea is that we, you know, tried to make this as cost neutral as possible. When we found objections, we tweaked the bill in order to take away as much as much of the state's risk as possible. If we can go to my first page of the slide presentation, the agenda. Basically, I'm going to spend a few minutes talking about the advantages of including the defined benefit option to this four-year workers, talk a little bit about the financial analysis, and then a little more on actuarial assumptions and unfunded liabilities. is the volume okay?
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So now on page three of the presentation, basically we find that your defined benefit option is more economical for the state. I'll talk about that in a minute. And it keeps jobs in Alaska. You know, Jesse mentioned this biologist, for example. I can't think of a state where it's more important to retain than to recruit. You know, young people love coming up to Alaska as a police officer, firefighter, biologist, you name it. But after 5 or 10 years, it's possible that they would want to leave this state for another state that has a defined benefit program. And I would think that, you know, you're the wrong state to want to be doing it this way. I can see other states might, but in your situation, job retention, I would imagine, is more critical than in other states. At the bottom of our page, that page three, you can see, we've structured this to be cost neutral, and in fact, it actually saves, some money in the first year. I've got a bar chart towards the end of this presentation that shows, you know, that trickles down by 15 years, it's down to zero because these safeguards that Jesse mentioned kick in, so that the cost savings stops, but there's no cost to the state. And that's basically by shifting the health cost inflation risk to the employees. Page four, why don't I skip over that, because I believe Jesse talked about that quite a bit, to give you all a choice. Page five, why should Alaska public workers have a defined benefit option? Essentially, because it's targeted to provide exactly what you need in terms of pension benefit, as opposed to defined contribution benefits. We'll talk about that in more detail later. And again, Alaska is one of about a quarter of the states that doesn't provide Social Security coverage for the vast majority of its employees. So I contend that the Alaska public workers hired since 2006, I wouldn't be surprised. In fact, I suspect they're the largest group of Americans that don't have any kind of safety net protection. Every other American, me in the private sector, policemen, firefighters, and other teachers in my state, Colorado, have a defined benefit plan of some form. You know, mine is Social Security, but only Alaska is the only substantially significant employer in the country that doesn't provide any kind of safety net. You know, right now it's only your post-2006 workers, but, you know, a decade or two from now it'll be the vast majority of your workers. The next page, six, the one that has the chart on it, illustrates, it illustrates the benefit differential between the latest tier of defined benefit. These are the people hired right before 2006 and the people hired after 2006. And let's look at teachers, the column on the left. The average teacher was hired at age 34, and if they work 25 years, which is fairly typical, they'll retire at 59. If they'd been hired before 2006, they would have a defined benefit of about 58% of their average pay. But our projections show that if they were in the new plan that hired just after 2006, that would only generate benefits of 33% of pay. So this is a pretty major reduction in their benefits, and is frankly the reason that these workers are asking for the option to be in a defined benefit program. Page seven just shows an example of those numbers. In this case, this $50,000 teacher would have close to $30,000 if she'd been hired right before 2006, barely $16,000, $17,000 if they're hired after. And even if she'd been, you know, working somewhere else with only Social Security, she would have had about $13,000 in annual pension. So there's a pretty big difference here. And the reason there's a difference is discussed on page 8 and the next few pages. Excuse me, this is the page that says, why DB more economically efficient? There we go. There's three reasons that it's economically more effective to provide a defined benefit. Now, you know, the citizenry of Alaska needs to pay for its public servants. They pay salaries, and they somehow need to have a mechanism so that they can use part of those salaries to retire. And of the two ways to do it, either a pool defined benefit plan or an individual defined contribution plan, there's just reasons that the defined benefit approach works better. Let me go to the next page. Page that says first strength of DB plans, longevity risk pooling. Essentially, you know, Jesse mentioned even a skilled investor that does pretty well, they may be a skilled investor, but they're not a skilled predictor of when they're going to die. It's hard for individuals that are retired to know precisely how long they need to make their nest egg last. Now, for wealthier individuals, that's not too much of a problem because you just adjust by your kids' inheritance being higher or lower than you anticipated. But for non-wealthier individuals, and most public sector workers are certainly in that camp, they need to try to figure out how long to make their money last. And so since they can't anticipate how long they're going to live, they tend to overestimate how long they're going to live because they don't want to take the risk of running out of money if they didn't die right at their average life expectancy. But the pension system is very good at figuring out how long a pool of workers will live. And that's what the next chart will tell. It's page 10. It's a chart with red and gray bars. Basically, if we look at a pool of 1,000 school teachers, all retiring at 62, if you were in a defined benefit approach, they only need to have the red bars in terms of how much money to pay these workers. But under the defined contribution approach, many of the workers will die before they thought they'd die, and there will be money left over. Now, this money is very valuable. It's money that they pass to their children, to their estates. But it's not the purpose of a retirement program. The idea is, why should the state set up a fund that provides extra money for the people that happen to die earlier than the average? And this represents about 24% of the assets in a defined contribution approach would end up going to the estates and not to the retirees. That's money that you can use in a defined benefit program to pay for other workers that live longer. Page 6, 7, and so on, and I'm sorry, I'll speed up. Essentially, are two of the other strengths of the defined benefit approach, and it has to do with investing. Page 11 and 12. Let's look at page 11. Basically, an individual, when they get older, they need to be more conservative in the way they invest. But a pool, such as the Alaska Retirement Management Board, does not. You know, they've got a longer time horizon, so they don't have to become more conservative. This adds investment return. And page 13 talks about, skip over page 12, page 13 talks about, you know, Jesse mentioned some individuals are really skilled, and yes, that's true, but on the average public worker is not as skilled as the average public professionally managed pension fund. You know, the Alaska Retirement Management Board has an excellent history of investing. They have had made returns north of 8% over the last few decades, but the average individuals don't. And there's some statistics at the bottom of page 13 shows about a 1% differential. And 1% per year over 20, 30 years is a lot of money. And that's why one of the reasons these plans are more effective. Now, let's look at page 14. You know, you've got legitimate concerns about the fear of unfunded liabilities. and a new defined benefit program does put the state at some risk of increasing liabilities. But the risk is exactly the same of reducing unfunded liabilities. In other words, if this pool of assets grows more than 8%, which the actuary and I and many other professionals believe is just as likely as earning less than 8%, then this would actually decrease the unfunded liabilities for the state. And of course the other unfunded liabilities you have would be lower as well. So while there is some risk that this would increase, there's also a risk of decrease. And frankly, that's perhaps your job as decision makers, that if things turn out better than expected, that you use that money to pay off other unfunded liabilities rather than improve benefits to increase future liabilities. That's the nuts and bolts of what we found. Let's move forward just to let's look at the page 17 that has the bar charts showing how the contributions for the PERS folks at least will be increasing a little bit to help pay for this. And then page 19, the other bar chart, is the numbers that were from the fiscal note we received yesterday, showing the savings. You know, there's you know, decent amount of savings in the first few years, as Jesse mentioned, around 2021, 2022, the PERS savings go away, and you know, it's projected that the retirees would have to start paying a larger chunk of their retiree health care. And by 2031, the teacher's savings also goes away. But there's still nearly $70 million of savings in the next 15 years, which I don't think is reason enough to support this. But the key is that this is designed to be cost neutral or better. You know, what we've done is tried to strip out the potential for bad things happening. And in conclusion, I'm on page 20 now. This approach is more economical for the state because it's more efficient, keeps jobs in the state, it gets rid of their Social Security problem of no safety net. It's been designed to generate about $10 million in savings in the first year, $70 million over 15 years, and it's done by some modifications that shift some of the risk back to the employees as opposed to the older tiers. Thank you for your attention. I'm certainly welcome to take questions, and I'll be participating in the rest of the
And thank you for helping us. It appears that you bring a lot of experience and expertise. Questions, comments from the committee? Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Fournier, you talked about savings numbers there. I think you said $70 million in savings. Have you discussed that number with the governor's office, with their actuaries, and do they agree or disagree with that number?
Senator Wilkowski, those numbers are from their report. So Mr. Barnhill can certainly comment on that. I believe he's testifying soon. I don't see why there'd be any dispute over this unless there's something we're not understanding from their report.
Okay. And then just one more, Mr. Chair. On the unfunded liability that currently exists, is that due mainly because of pensions or defined benefit pensions or because of health care?
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, I'm not sure how it's precisely been split up, but clearly health care is a huge portion of the unfunded liability. I haven't seen any specific studies that try to break it out between the two. The assets aren't precisely dedicated between the two. But when you think of Alaska compared to the other states in the country, and you look at little surveys that show a relatively high unfunded liability, that's clearly because of health care, because the only other state in the country that includes health care in their pension system is the state of Ohio. And I was engaged by the Ohio legislature recently to help analyze their pension reform, and they're addressing it through retiree health care. You know, they're keeping their costs down by adjusting retiree health care. I think other states around the country, the other 48, other than Alaska and Ohio, will be having to visit those issues in the next few decades.
Senator Wilkowski.
One last question, Mr. Chair. And just on the issue of defined benefit, what's available for public employees and teachers, are you aware of any other states that have where public employees do not receive Social Security and also don't receive some sort of defined benefit plan?
Through the chair, Senator Wielichowski, no. Not only no other states, but basically no other major employers. I know Detroit, for example, that in their bankruptcy plan of adjustment is proposing no future defined benefits for their workers. So depending on how much Detroit grows relative to Alaska, maybe they'll beat you out as the largest employer. But no, there are certainly no states. There could be some cities somewhere. And, of course, no one in the private sector, because the private sector all has mandatory Social Security.
All right, we're going to be a little short on time. To the sponsor and so on, I have a couple questions I want to get answered, and we can get them next time. Is the new plan you're offering the pension based on high years, and what is that? Under what circumstances does the employer contribution change? The implication that it doesn't change for the retirement, but indeed for the health cost partition. As those costs get up, both pay. And I'd really enjoy somebody, maybe Mr. Barnhouse can tell us how Alaska's public employees, I understood they chose not to have the Social Security, but I'd really enjoy having the history and what went into that decision. And it seemed to me the implication from Mr. Fornia's comments was that if a employee lives a lot longer than he planned, then the principal of the account, the money it's earning, or the citizens of Alaska will end up making up that delta. So any of those you can answer for me really quickly, William?
Briefly, Mr. Chairman, Jesse Keel, staff to Senator Egan, the pension calculations work the same way as the most recent pension tiers. So, for instance, for PERS, Tier 3, it's based on your highest five consecutive years average compensation. I will have to get back with you for further understanding on how employer costs change, because I want to make sure I'm answering the question you mean to ask. And the details of how public employees in Alaska got off of Social Security, I can also get you that history.
Yeah, I'd enjoy that.
Yeah.
If you for one, excuse me, if one of you will step back, I'd like to give Mr. Barnhill a quick chance here to respond to the fiscal note. Senator Geisel, you had a question?
Not right now. Thank you, sir.
We're obviously not going to get through all of this today, and we'll revisit it. But sure. As long as you chose to come and join us, I wanted to get at least your overall response to the information that was presented to us.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mike Barnhill, Deputy Commissioner, Department of Administration. I didn't bring any prepared testimony today. We have concerns with any proposal to turn on a pure defined benefit plan for state employees and school districts again. And those concerns are borne out by the current reality that we face. We turned on defined benefits for our state employees and teachers several decades ago, and today, as a result of those promises that we made and that we intend to keep, we have $11.9 billion unfunded liability, and we're struggling with how exactly to face that, and I trust that the legislature and the administration will come up with the right way to face that. But the fact remains that we're struggling to deal with how to meet the promises that we have made to date. The state also, looking forward, there's a fair amount of fiscal uncertainty with respect to where are the revenues going to come from to meet the needs of state government and state citizens over the next 10, 20, 30, 40 years. We need to bear in mind that when we turn on a defined benefit promise, we're making a promise that if it's for a 20-year-old new state employee that we need to keep for up to 70 years. So when we make these promises, we need to look forward and ask ourselves, what is the fiscal situation of the state going to be, not just in the 2020s, but the 2050s and the 2060s? And I suggest to the committee that there is a fair amount of uncertainty with respect to those decades. Now, the state is blessed with revenues that we have in our various reserve accounts, and we can meet the questions of how are we going to pay off the promises that we made some decades ago. We have the resources to do that. We'll figure a way out to do that. But I am concerned when I look forward 30 or 40 years with respect to what will our fiscal resources be in those decades if a new unfunded liability should arise. Primary concern we have with defined benefit, from an employee perspective, there's a lot of sense to it. We get the benefits. We get why employees would like defined benefits. But as a state, we have to look at our balance sheet and our revenue resources honestly and ask, where will the resources come from if there is a financial downturn in the investment markets in the 2030s, 2040s, 2050s? Can we make that promise today, certain that we will be able to meet those promises even if there is a financial downturn? I would suggest that let's fix the promises that we've made to date. Let's address those. Let's address the fiscal uncertainty that the state faces today with respect to where our revenues are going to come from tomorrow before we make new promises to a new generation of defined benefit employees.
Questions for Mr. Barnhill, Senator Coghill?
Thank you. There are probably three or four questions, just top-level questions. The issue of Social Security came up, and I know that we do have a supplemental benefit system, and I think that was mostly with the PERS. There was some formulation for TERS that I don't probably understand that well. Could you help us understand? I know that the supplemental benefit system is supposed to be at least a part to mirror some of the Social Security issue, if I understand correctly. Could you help us understand that a little bit?
Sure. Through the chair, Senator Coghill, I believe it was in 1981, and Kathy Lee, our chief pension officer, is here, and she can come up and join me to correct me on the details. But there was an opening in federal law to allow public entities, state governments, and local municipalities to opt out of the Social Security system. And so opting out under federal law, they would have to opt into a qualified Social Security replacement. For the state of Alaska as an employer, we designed the supplemental annuity system, sometimes we call that SBS, as the qualified Social Security replacement system. And that was put into place, and the basic structure of it is a defined contribution structure where the employer contributes 6.13% of the employee's salary, and the employee matches that with 6.13% for a total of 12.26%. That I believe those percentages were the same as what Social Security was charging employees in 1981. That's what the state of Alaska did. Some municipalities in the state opted out of Social Security, but rather than opt into the supplemental annuity system, some did, but some did not. Some adopted PERS as the qualified Social Security replacement. Now, the mechanism by which that happened was that referenda were conducted, and the state of Alaska employees held a referendum and voted to opt out of Social Security into SBS. And I believe those referenda were conducted within each employer that opted out.
And under the TERS system, Mr. Chairman?
Under the TERS system, the issue there goes back, I believe, to the original enactment of Social Security in the 1930s. And generally speaking, teachers did not participate in Social Security, and I believe that's of long-standing nature.
One other question, Mr. Chairman.
Certainly.
It looks to me like under the way this bill is devised, that the risk would fall upon the employee. Have you had a chance to study through what it looks like they're talking about the health risk falling on the employee, and yet you still see some potential risk? So it looks to me what they want to do is pool the money together, And under certain risk conditions, the risk of expanding costs fall upon the employee. And yet you still are depending upon a pretty good return on investment on the pooled money. Is that where you see the risk for the pooled money?
I think there's, through the chair, Senator Conkle, there's multiple risks, again, with any defined benefit plan. And as Mr. Fornia stated and Mr. Keel stated, you know, you can make a case that some of those risks are offset by the benefits. But in general, under the structure of SB 30, the risk of increasing health care costs does fall on the retiree. And you can see that in the buck chart starting in FY22, the retiree premiums start going up. Buck is concerned that under their view of the future, those premiums could rise so sharply that retirees will simply stop electing retiree health and the plan will essentially implode because it does not have sufficient participation. In any defined benefit plan, there's multiple risks, and the risks are essentially driven by what the actuary projects with respect to investment return, inflation, mortality, date of retirement. And if they get any of those projections wrong, which they will, those risks can create a new unfunded liability. The bill does not address the one of the primary risks, and that is the risk of not earning the 8% if in year one. And that's why our note is essentially indeterminate. We recognize, and our actuary, to Senator Wilkowski's comment, did come up with those numbers that produced the $70 million savings. So we recognize that all things being equal, that bill will produce that saving within that time period. But in year one, if there's an investment loss, that could entirely offset any savings.
Right. Senator Wilkowski.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. This issue's been debated ever since I've been here. And I know there's a lot of blame to go around for why we have the unfunded liability. I think we had the actuarial malpractice case, which you were deeply involved in. We had the legislature not funding adequately decades ago like they should have. But the point remains, Alaska is the only state in the nation where its public employees don't have a defined benefit and don't have Social Security. We just heard Mr. Fournier say we're the largest employer in the United States, where our employees don't have access to a defined benefit and don't have access to Social Security. So moving forward, there's a bill on the House side, which seems to me to be, I know it's not the bill before us, Mr. Chair, but I think I'm just trying to figure out a compromise because this issue comes up every year. And maybe that's a compromise to this bill. Maybe you could work with the sponsor here, because what that bill does is it says instead of the employee making the 6.75 contribution, the state making the 6.75 contribution, and then it being managed in a defined benefit pool, or being managed rather by the employee themselves, let the employees get together and collectively manage it themselves. Once the state makes or the municipality makes their contribution, they're off the hook completely. Is that something that the administration would support? That seems to me to be a fair compromise because that removes your liability, gives them their defined benefit that they want. Why is that not a compromise?
Commissioner Barnum.
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, it certainly is a compromise. Is it something the administration is willing to support? We've been in discussions with the proponents of that bill for the better part of 3 years. We do think that something short of pure defined benefit is worthy of consideration and discussion. Whether that particular vehicle is something that we would support, I'm going to defer on that. There's a fair amount of complexity with that bill, and one of the primary issues that we have with it is that, and for good reasons, the bill puts any overtime earned by a peace officer or a firefighter into Tier 4 and then all of their services in Tier 5 under the bill. And that, for the first time, requires us to keep track of people in two tiers, and that requires a fair amount of work to our computer systems. There's definitely some complexity. But with respect to your basic question, is there room for compromise? And I think the answer is yes.
Other questions, comments? Thank you. may ask you to be available again when we come back to this. I have chosen to let the presentation actuarial and a little bit of insight from another perspective at the expense for people who come to testify at the public hearing. I think it was a good choice and it was best, but it is in some senses rude to you that came for here. I think we'll get this back up, and I'll have to let you know, we're looking at our schedule and give another chance. Is there anyone here who couldn't come back at another time in the next 10 days? If so, please come forward now. Sir, come on.
Good morning. For the record, my name is Jacob Barra. My wife and I are both educators, and we live with our two young children in Shugiak. I'm a constituent of Senator Dyson's, and I want to thank him for this opportunity. I'm here to support passage of SB 30, which would allow public employees a choice between a defined contribution or defined benefit retirement plan. A majority of Alaska's teachers come from out of state. That was the case for my wife and I. I was finishing school and completing 8 years of service in the Marine Corps Reserve. We did our research, and in 2003, we felt Alaska offered a positive job outlook. The good pay and secure retirement, along with the natural beauty of the state, were the deciding factors. We made our choice responsibly with the goal of putting our roots down and starting a family. I can tell you with certainty that based on the current job outlook and the current retirement plan, we wouldn't make that same decision today. We simply couldn't risk our family's future. Here are the numbers. According to a recent report to the Arm Board, of the 3,037 teachers hired since July 1st, 2006, only 632 have stayed more than 5 years. And of the 12,297 PERS employees hired in that same period, only 989 have stayed. It is my belief that restoring the ability to earn a secure retirement can create the incentive to stay and help turn this trend around. For years, I've been working with legislators to find a better retirement option for my colleagues. Most agree that something needs to be done. They recognize that the lack of a secure retirement, along with the inability for public employees to contribute to Social Security, puts the state at risk of having to provide more social services and protections down the road when retiree savings run out. Legislators on both sides of the aisle have expressed support for a blended system that offers the choice of a defined contribution or defined benefit, as long as it was financially responsible and didn't put the state at risk with rising health care costs. I believe SB 30 addresses these issues by offering a plan that can save the state of Alaska money, along with adding a check and balance to the employee contribution of health coverage every 5 years.
Can you summarize?
Last paragraph. I look forward to being a part of the solution. I welcome ways we can strengthen this bill and protect both public employees and the state of Alaska. But every year we hesitate to address this issue, we kick the can down the road. It's another year teachers, firefighters, police, and other public employees aren't contributing to a more secure retirement that honors their hard work and dedication to the community and to the state of Alaska. The time to act is now. I respectfully urge you to support SB 30, and I sincerely thank you for this opportunity.
Questions? I thank you for both this presentation and the one we heard at Chugach Senior Center. You were a breath of fresh air in a somewhat rambunctious public hearing, and I appreciate both your manner and your information.
Thank you very much.
Is there anybody else here? Sir.
Good morning, members of the committee. My name is Brandon Weinbarger. I live in Fairbanks and I'm a special education teacher at Nordale Elementary. I'm a member of the Fairbanks Education Association and I'm a constituent of Senator John Coghill.
You have chosen wisely.
I moved to Alaska and began my career in education in August of 2006, just after the introduction of the Defined Contributions Plan. Current high teacher turnover rates in Alaska are a problem. I have seen many good teachers come and go. They arrive with such excitement, which then slowly recedes, erodes, helped on by ever-increasing awareness of a poor teacher's retirement system, and then it's back to the lower 48. is like Alaska is renting teachers for 2, 3, 4 years at a time. These high turnover rates erode a school's staff's ability to function effectively or to develop any type of cohesiveness. This limits the staff's overall ability to serve the needs of the students, the very people that they are in charge of educating. Let's face it, no one gets into teaching for the great pay. To be a teacher is to have answered a calling. I teach special education because all students deserve an upbeat and fully committed teachers who look forward to working with them on a day-to-day basis. I consider myself to be a professional and talented educator, and I take pride in that. But a profession's associated retirement system is very important. The uncertainty of the defined contribution plan makes it very difficult for one to plan for the future, including retirement. All public employees need and deserve a reliable pension plan. Furthermore, Alaska's public school teachers do not receive any Social Security benefits, which only adds further uncertainty when attempting to make retirement plans. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Questions?
Thank you for coming before us, and it's always nice to have a constituent come testify before a committee. One of the things that this particular program looks like to me is going to do is going to mount up the risk to the individual teacher, probably quite similarly to the this defined contribution plan that we presently have. I know that the pooling is one of the benefits, but according to at least the department at this point, one of the questions that we're going to have to answer is how far out can we look at that risk, and do we think that the investment stability is going to get us there? I don't know that, and we'll listen to some of the people testifying. I don't know what to do about the Social Security issue, and that's why I asked about our annuity program, because there may be ways that we can do something along that line as well. But you know, I'm certainly open to this discussion, but it looks to me like the employee still bears the risk. And I'll kind of have to weigh that as we move forward on this. And one of the things that we have to deal with as a legislature is it's a one-way door. And just like you, you'll get one chance to opt in. Without us examining the risk, I don't think that'd be wise for us to have a one-way door for you or for the state to say you can go in, but you can never come out of this particular system. So we'll probably weigh it very, very thoroughly, trying to figure out what do those risk lines look like. Because even when we went to the defined contribution, the risk line to us looked at our debt as well as can we manage to keep that system. Now, going back to a defined benefit program, we're going to have to kind of rethink that whole part again. Have you seen any credible proposals on the Social Security question outside of this?
I have not, but I'd have to defer to the actuary on that.
Yeah. And those are the questions I'm going to ask myself along the way as well. So just for what it's worth. Anyway, thanks for coming to testify.
Thank you. Senator Dyson has stepped out, so I'm going to preside over the rest of the meeting. Is there anyone else here in the room that would not be able to come back at the next hearing? We do have a couple folks on the phone. If committee members are willing to stay, we meet until 10:30, so we can fit in at least one more. I see Derek Say, I'm mispronouncing your last name, Derek. You're an Anchorage, you're with the Alaska, or excuse me, Anchorage Police Department Employees Association. Can you hear us, Derek?
Yes, thank you, Senator Diesel. This is Derek Scher. The last name certainly is difficult. I'm the president of the Anchorage Police Department Employees Association, and I really appreciate the committee taking the time to hear the testimony today. I'll be rather brief so that we can get to the other person, but you know, the Anchorage Police Department is suffering a staffing problem. I learned yesterday that the May Police Academy is unlikely to fill, despite efforts by the municipality to change the testing procedures, including the elimination or change of one of the tests that previously had eliminated up to 50% of our candidates. Even with that maneuver, we're still unable to fill a solid 28-member police academy. And as Mr. Fornia mentioned earlier, as far as I know, the Anchorage Police Department is the only metropolitan police department in the United States where the police employees have no access to, and I'll put it in the courtesy quotes, a defined benefit system, whether it be Social Security or a pension. We had many of our employees call around the country to similarly sized and larger departments, and we were unable to find any department that was facing the situation that we had. And also, the Anchorage Police Department employees do not have access to SBS, so we're just simply out of market. One of the issues I wanted to bring up that's kind of a discrete issue is something that relates to Social Security. Our primary source of police applicants and police employees is the military, generally the United States Army and Air Force, probably due to the J-Bear complex that we have here in Anchorage. I myself am an Army veteran. Of course, people that serve active duty military earn credit towards Social Security while serving. And then once hired at the Anchorage Police Department, you essentially lose that credit in Social Security because of the windfall elimination provision, et cetera. For myself, a Tier 2 PERS member, you know, that's something I can manage because of the benefit that I have. But for the newer employees, of course, that's a major hit. Because they're going to lose benefits that they earned while in the military or with other employers, and then they come to the Anchorage Police Department and have neither a pension, SBS, nor Social Security. And that's really starting to hurt us. For the first time in decades, we've actually seen younger police employees leaving the Anchorage Police Department for other departments in the lower 48. Recently, Denver was able to hire three of our officers primarily along pension lines, and weather's a factor, and family and other things as well, but pension was something that was mentioned, and I'm very concerned about the future of our department because of this, and I'm done pending any questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Scherr. Questions from the committee? All right. Seeing none, I see that we have someone at the Sitka LIO, Beverly Brill with ASEA. Beverly, can you hear us in Sitka?
Yes, I can.
Great. We have about 3 minutes left. Welcome.
Thank you. Good morning, Madam Chairman. I'm Beverly Burrow from Sitka. I'm a member of the Alaska State Employees Association as well as a constituent of Senator Bert Stedman. I've worked for the City and Borough of Sitka and participated in the State of Alaska PERS and SBS systems for 24 years as a Tier 2 employee with a defined benefit plan, which I very much appreciate. Through the years, I've seen many changes in the retirement system. It went from defined benefits to defined contributions, which does not attract or retain long-term employees. It also causes inequity in the workforce by virtue of having people work side by side with different retirement plans. My family is very important to me. My mother retired from the Sitka Pioneer Home. My brother, Gary Bart, is a retired teacher with Tier 1 benefits. And I have a niece who is a Tier 4, fifth-generation Sitkan, who is a first-year teacher in Sitka and also a member of the State of Alaska Retirement System by virtue of being with the Teachers Association. All public employees need a reliable retirement system which will allow them to provide for themselves and their families after leaving the workforce. They also would hopefully be able to still afford to live and stay in the state of Alaska. In order to ensure that the future generations are assured that that services are provided by the best teachers, state, and municipal employees, we must offer them a reasonable benefit package, which includes allowing them the choice of either defined benefits or defined contributions in their retirement plan. Please support and pass Senate Bill 30. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much, Beverly, for your testimony. Questions for Beverly? All right. Andy Holloman is there in Anchorage. He's with the Anchorage NEA. Andy, can you hear us?
Yes, I can, and I would be willing to come at a later date if that facilitates the committee.
That'd be great, Andy. It certainly would give you more time to speak on the subject if you would be willing to wait until the next meeting.
I'll be brief at the next meeting, too. Thank you.
All right, great. Thank you very much. So public testimony on Senate Bill 30 will be kept open. The chair will determine when the bill will be heard again, and we will adjourn at this time. The time is 10:30 a.m. Thank you.